Well, I wish I had some good news to deliver. I have actually two bits of bad news. One is that the mean that I just graded for this test, 47%. The second bit of bad news is, I'd have to check to be sure, but I'm pretty sure that's the lowest mean I've ever had on any test in any course that I've taught at any college. I don't say that to beat up on you, make you feel even worse. I just want to put things in perspective. That means definitely things have to somehow improve or almost no one's going to make it through this course. Now, like I said, the first day, the other things besides the tests bring you up. But the tests are big, valuable chunks, and you can't withstand repeated scores this low. Hopefully it's because, maybe just by coincidence, everyone hated that unit. I don't know what went on. And it's not every score was terrible, but obviously that's a terrible mean. All right. So I also hope that all of you love plants, because we're just about to enter Unit 3 now. We're, in terms of units or tests, we are now halfway done. Two units left. We're entering Unit 3 today. And the reason I say I hope you like plants is because Unit 3 is entirely plants. Four plant chapters. And if you truly enjoy plants, then maybe that will make it easier for you to learn this stuff to the point of getting a much higher mean than 47. If you hate plants, you might be in for a rough unit, but hopefully you'll change your mind. In any case, let's go on to look at this first chapter, which is an overview of structure and growth in plants. Now, if we step back for a second and think about what we've already learned about plants, remember that it's a true clade. Plants is a true clade, a monophyletic taxon. So one group. But you can split that into two major kinds of plants, right? What are those? What are the two major kinds of plants? Right. Non-vascular plants, which are also called bryophytes, and vascular plants. Okay, then you can take just the vascular plants and subdivide that again. What are the two major kinds of vascular plants? Can't hear you, sorry. Not yet. That's a division of the division that we're thinking of. All vascular plants have vessels, right? That's what makes them vascular. But not all vascular plants have seeds. So the next subdivision is seedless vascular plants, like the ferns, and seeded plants, right? Okay, so now if you just take the seeded plants as its own group, you can subdivide that. And that's what you were answering there. The two seeded plants groups, two major groups, are the gymnosperms and the angiosperms, right? Gymnosperms are the ones that means naked seed because they aren't in their own little chambers. The conifers are the most familiar examples of those. Angiosperm means chambered seed, right? What are angiosperms also known as? It's kind of a scientific name for what is the common name for angiosperms as a group. Well, what are the three hallmarks of angiosperms? Flowers. So they're also called the flowering plants. That's what I was trying to ask for. And you have the three so-called Fs, right? flowers, double fertilization, kind of qualifies as an F, and fruit. Only the angiosperms have those. And that's as far as we got up until today's test. Now I want to subdivide again just the angiosperms, which are the by far the most successful plants, right? And most of the plant species that are alive today are the angiosperms. You can subdivide the angiosperms into two groups shown on this first slide, which are the monocots and the eudicots. And the cot part that both of those words share is really shorthand or an abbreviation of cotyledon. A cotyledon is also known as a seed leaf. So it's a leaf-like structure that is part of the seed. Now, if you think about what a leaf is, just in general in any given plant, in a typical plant, the leaf is a specialized structure for photosynthesis, but photosynthesis is a way that the plant feeds itself, right? So leaves feed the plant in most cases. Well, a seed leaf has that same function. It transfers nutrients to the embryo that by definition is in that seed, right? Remember, it's not a seed until you have an embryo growing in it. Successful fertilization has already happened for it to be a seed. So any given living seed has a cotyledon, at least one cotyledon, if it is an angiosperm seed. And that's what cot stands for. So monocot literally means one cotyledon. In the group of angiosperms that we call the monocots, those seeds, each one has just one seed leaf or cotyledon. Eudicot means truly two cotyledons. All right? So that is the one major difference between these two groups. And that's the difference that's the basis for the two different names. But that's just one difference. Each row in this table illustrates a different difference between the two groups. All right, so let's look at those. The embryo is one we just discussed, one cotyledon versus two cotyledons. That's why they're named what they are. But there's also a difference with respect to leaf venation. Now, venation, the veen part of that, means vein. And venation of a leaf refers to the pattern that those vessels or veins make in the leaf. And so this is one way, unlike the embryos, where you'd have to dissect the seed and therefore kill it in order to tell how many cotyledons it has. By looking at the leaf venation pattern, you can make it a determination if you don't know. All you know it's an angiosperm, but you don't know whether it's monocot or eudicot. You can do that without harming the plant just by looking at the leaf venation pattern. There are exceptions to all of these, just like in most of biology. But in most cases, monocots have veins in their leaves that run the length of the leaf and are parallel to each other. Like in a corn leaf, a corn plant is a typical monocot. Corn's an example of a grass. Grasses in general are monocots. On the other hand, a eudicot leaf usually has a venation pattern that is highly branched. All right? Or net-like, as this book says. Another example is in how the vascular bundles, or the vascular tissue, is arranged in the stems of a plant, of the angiosperm. This is one that you'd have to actually cut into the plant to look at as well. But if you make a cross section through the stem, as opposed to the roots, for instance, a typical monocot will have vascular bundles that that are really those bundles of the vessels that are scattered throughout the thickness of the stem cross section, like you see in the cartoon. Whereas in a typical eudicot, those vascular bundles appear in a circle, just like this. The roots are also different between these two. In a typical monocot, there is no single root that is drastically bigger than the rest. There is no taproot, in other words. Instead, the roots are, it's called a fibrous root system because the branches are all pretty much the same size. Eudicots, though, do have a so-called taproot, which is much bigger than the rest of the roots and is mainly for anchoring that thing in the ground well. And then branches of the taproot are more fibrous, and they do the other main job of the root system. Root system isn't just about holding the vascular plant in place. It's mainly, actually, about allowing water and the things that are dissolved in that water to enter the plant through the vascular tissue in the roots. Okay, another one is pollen. You wouldn't have to destroy the plant to look at this, but you would need a microscope because pollen grains are microscopically small. If you were to compare them, though, a monocot pollen grain typically will have just a single opening, whereas a dicot pollen grain will have three, as you see here. And then finally, flowers. Remember, these are two groups of angiosperms. These words only apply to angiosperms, so those are by definition flowering plants. They both have flowers. Well, in a typical monocot, the number of petals in a flower will usually be either three or some multiple of three. Three, six, nine, whatever. Eudicots have multiples of four or five in their petals, usually. That's another one that you can easily do without destroying the plant at all. Look at the leaf venation, look at the number of petals. Although some flowers, it's hard to tell how many petals there are because they can be tiny or there can just be a hell of a lot. All right, let's go on to two. Look at the basic anatomy of the body of an angiosperm. Well, at the most basic level, an entire plant, which is an organism, an individual, consists of a shoot system and a root system. And the shoot system is simply the collection of structures that grows above ground, whereas the root system is below ground. That's how it usually works. There are some exceptions to that that we'll look at, but that's really what defines, I mean, that's how it's easy to tell whether you're in the root system or the shoot system. Is it growing below ground or above ground? The shoot system itself is more diverse in structures than the root system. Here we have what kind of angiosperm? What kind is depicted in this cartoon? I don't mean what species. I mean which of the two groups we just talked about is this? It's a eudicot because, well, there's a couple reasons you can tell that, right? It has a taproot. That's enough evidence right there. But also, if you look at the shoot system, the flower has five petals, a multiple of five. And also, the leaf venation is highly branched rather than being parallel. So anyway, the shoot system is more diverse in structures. The root system contains just roots, branches of roots. The shoot system, on the other hand, consists of stems, buds, flowers, leaves. So it's a little bit more diverse in terms of structure. Leaves, by the way, in most cases, are specialized organs for photosynthesis. Photosynthesis, you should hopefully you remember some of the stuff from about photosynthesis from 181. But photosynthesis occurs because light gets absorbed by photosynthetic pigments, right? Chief among them is chlorophyll, which is why plants look green to us, right? Because of the chlorophyll in them. Well, anywhere on a plant's body that is green, it's capable of photosynthesizing. But usually, the greenest parts of the plant, and sometimes the only green parts, are the leaves. So leaves are specialized for the photosynthesis, which creates carbohydrates, which can then be converted into other organic compounds. It feeds the plant, but it also gives it raw materials for anything it needs to make, really. That's produced directly in the leaves, but the whole plant needs that stuff. So those things that are produced by photosynthesis get transported from the leaves to the rest of the plant. The leaf, a typical leaf, by the way, has a part of it that you might be tempted to call the stem of the leaf, because that's the part that attaches to the rest of the plant. It's not really a stem, though. It's called a petiole. Petiole is the stem-like part of the leaf. Now, shoots, all of these things are shoots. A leaf is a shoot, a flower is a shoot, because they're all part of the shoot system. Roots aren't shoots, though. Roots are the underground parts. When it comes to buds, which we see a couple examples of here, several examples on this cartoon, there are two categories of buds, and buds are sites of brand new growth. But there are two categories. Some buds occur on the very ends of shoots. Not necessarily at the very top, which is also an example, but at the very end of any branch. And those are called apical buds. Now, apical is just an adjective form of apex. So apical means of the apex. The apex of something is the tip. The other category of buds are axillary buds. And axillary is just the adjective of axil, which really means angle. The axil of a plant is any place where you have a branch point. Branch points actually are called nodes, just like they are in phylogenetic trees. In fact, that's why they're called nodes in phylogenetic trees, because nodes are branch points on plants. But wherever you have a node, that means you're going to also have an axil, because the axil is the angle formed by those two pieces that branch. And so axillary just means in a place where there's a branch, where that angle is made. We use the same terminology for our own body. Not axil, but axilla. A-X-I-L-L-A is what on your own body? What is that the anatomically proper name for on a human body? Anyone know? It's the name for the armpit, because it's just like a branch point on a plant, right? Where it branches from the trunk. Okay, so those are two categories of buds, not because they're really fundamentally different kinds of buds, just on, based on where their placement is. Now, flowers are shoots because they're part of the shoot system, but notice that they are labeled as reproductive shoots because that's the purpose of a flower. It houses the reproductive organs, and if things go right and fertilization takes place, the flower will develop into a fruit containing seeds that are, of course, contain embryos of the next generation of plants. So it's all about reproduction. On the other hand, leaves are examples of vegetative shoots. Vegetation means simply growing. It's not about producing another generation. Okay, now, anything? Oh, the only thing I didn't mention is that piece of the chute system between two nodes is simply called an internode, which literally means between nodes, right? So there are several internodes here, but only one of them is labeled as internode. Starts and ends at a node. All right, that's basic anatomy. Let's go on to three. Here we have a picture of a corn seedling. And it's not really so much important that it's corn. The important point here is what's happening with this brand new root system that's developing. It looks like it's very hairy or fuzzy. It's not really hair, of course. So there's a bunch of tiny branches in this brand new shoot system, root system. But actually, most of the branching is invisible. These are very fine already, but each of those tiny strands is really many cells big, right? If you got in there and looked at individual cells that make up end-to-end these fine branches, even the cells themselves would have tiny little hair-like projections from them, which are called microvilli. You have microvilli in your own body. The cells that line your small intestine. Well, first of all, your small intestine is folded. It's not just a smooth tube. It has many folds in it. And then the folds themselves have folds in them. And then the cells that make up those folds on folds have microvilli. And each of these things, the major folds, the folds on those folds, and then the microvilli on those cells, each one of those amplifies the amount of surface area compared to just a smooth-walled tube. If you had a smooth-walled tube, most of the nutrients that you take in as food would pass all the way through you before you got a chance to absorb them, because absorption requires an epithelium to get that stuff into your body. Similarly, the more branched you make a root system, including these microvilli on individual cells, the more chance there is to absorb as much water in a given amount of time while it's still there in the soil. So it really maximizes the efficiency. By the way, these are called root hairs, even though, of course, they're not hair. By analogy, they look like hairs. That's why they're called that. Okay, for the next few slides, we're going to look at some exceptional structures. I told you how things are in most cases, but there are exceptions. And so in slide 4, these are unusual roots. These are all roots. Storage root, like a radish, is unlike most roots because most roots are just pretty slender, right? They're there to hold the thing in place and, like I said, to take in water and dissolve nutrients. Storage roots, on the other hand, are bulbous, large structures. But they aren't there for the normal reason that other branches of roots are there. They're there for storage, specifically storage of nutrients. So I talked earlier about the plant, about the fact that leaves, being the primary photosynthetic organs, produce the food via photosynthesis, but then that food gets transported to the rest of the plant. In a storage root, a lot of those nutrients get delivered to the root system to produce a storage root, which we end up eating if we dig it up and, you know, like a radish. But that plant is storing that for later use. Exactly like our liver stores extra glucose that's coming in that we don't need at the moment. It stores that as glycogen for later. Or we store things as fat in our body as well for later use. Pneumatophores, to the left of that, pneumo means air. Pneumatophores are modified roots in plant species that live in very waterlogged soils. Bogs and places like that. Swamps. Problem with a waterlogged soil is that there aren't very many air-filled spaces in the soil. It's just pretty much like water. And even though there is oxygen in water, which is required by the root system for the same reason we need oxygen, there's not nearly as much oxygen in water as there is in an airspace. So a normal soil, even when it's wet soil, it still has a lot of airspace in it if you were to examine it. Not a waterlogged soil, though. So these things would smother, basically, if they didn't have what effectively are snorkels. Pneumatophores are modified roots that are like straws that extend all the way out of the surface of the water and allow for gaseous air to get down into where it's otherwise watery. These strangling aerial roots that you see on the right are also unusual roots. By the way, a word that means occurring in an unexpected place is adventitious. And so these strangling aerial roots are adventitious roots because they're growing above ground, which is unexpected for a root system, right? How this happens, by the way, is that originally there was a conventional plant, meaning conventional in the sense that it was growing with its root system in the ground and the shoot system above the ground. It was there already. Then this species came along and started growing on top of the tree that was already there, and then started sending roots down the body of that tree that was already there until it finally got to the ground. And it was a parasite of the first tree, until eventually it grew so big that the original tree is just dead in the middle of in there, and this one is now living as a shell outside of it. And you can see it encased this building as well. So that's also unusual. Most plants start in the ground and grow up. This one started higher and grew down to the soil. Okay, slide 5. Those previous ones were all roots. Here we're looking at stems that are unusual. These are all stems. First is the rhizomes, upper left. Now you would be easily forgiven if you said that's a root, because it's reasonable to think that's a root. It's growing underground, but that's what makes it an unusual stem. Rhizomes, and in fact the name means root. Rhize means root, but it's not truly a root. It's actually a stem that grows underground and usually grows horizontally, as you see. Some species have those. Tubers, you're familiar with. Tuber really just means lump. There's all kinds of tubers, but potatoes are good familiar examples of tubers. You might think that those are roots, like a radish is. A radish is a root. A potato is not a root. They both grow underground, but a potato is actually a modified stem. And it's a storage stem, just like a radish is a storage root, doing the same job, but potatoes are truly stems, whereas radishes are actually roots. And then stolons are also stems. Now, stolons are pretty much like rhizomes, only stolons do grow above the ground, as you would expect for a stem, but unlike most stems, they grow horizontal right on the surface of the soil. And then every once in a while, when they get long enough, a branch of the stolon will grow into the ground like a new plant. And when you see a group of these, it'll look like there might be several different individuals, but it's really all one individual. Okay, let's go to 6. In this one, we have all modified leaves. A typical leaf, which these aren't, is a wide, flat organ. Wide, flat, and thin. And it makes good sense that they're wide, flat, and thin because by being wide, they can catch as much sunlight as possible, right? That's their job, is to absorb photons for photosynthesis. That's if you can get away with it. A lot of plants can, but when you make a wide, thin, flat structure, you really have a very high surface to volume ratio on that thing, right? And therefore, you have the possibility of losing a lot of water. And also becoming very cold. The leaves get much colder than the rest of the plant when it gets cold. Just like your fingers and toes get much colder than your trunk, because they're thinner. So that's something plants have to deal with, and therefore not all leaves are conventionally shaped. Well, some leaves don't even photosynthesize at all. That's these spines of the cactus you see here, familiar to us. Remember I said that any green part of a plant can photosynthesize. Well, in a cactus, the leaves don't photosynthesize at all. The leaves have evolved a different purpose entirely, which is protection of the plant. And they are spiny. Not only does that protect them as armor, basically, but also they don't lose any water because they're so, or they lose almost no water because they're so tough. The fleshy part of the cactus, the green part, which is really the stem, not the leaf, that's where the photosynthesis takes place. But it also, I mean, if this had conventional leaves, not only would it not be protected, the main reason this occurs in really hot places is if they had conventional leaves, it would lose too much water, which just isn't there in a desert by definition. Too dry a place. Okay, tendrils are to the right of that. Tendrils are leaves, as all these ones on this slide are, but they are leaves that are modified for attachment to other things to hold the plant in place. And these act like little nooses, almost. Doesn't happen very fast, but if you look at a time-lapse movie of these, which you can easily find online, the tendrils, as they grow longer and longer, they also make circles, feeling for things. And when they finally hit something, that end will wrap around whatever it is, which could be another plant, by the way, or something on your house, whatever, until it gets a grip on that. The rest of the plant is over here where the tendril, where the tendril is attached to, and then the whole length of it starts to coil up, which makes it shorter, and that drags the plant over to the support structure. Lower left are reproductive leaves, obviously leaves that are modified for the purpose of reproduction, which typical leaves aren't, right? Leaves are typically vegetative. Well, even though these are reproductive structures, it's not sexual reproduction. So it's fundamentally different from what a flower does. Sex mixes up the genes, right, from two parents, so it produces a genetically distinct individual. That's not what's happening here. In plants that have reproductive leaves, they are just structures that easily fall off. These little leaflets will easily, if they're brushed, fall off. And they'll hit the soil underneath. And if the conditions are right, some of them will start growing a root system and become a clone, a genetically identical individual compared to that one parent. So it's asexual reproduction. Plants are capable, some species are capable of both sexual and asexual reproduction. And then finally, storage leaves, like the onion. It's unusual to find a leaf underground because most leaves are for a collection of light and there's no light underground. But these are modified leaves. This is another version of a storage device, just like the radish, just like the potato, only the radish was a root, the potato was a stem, the onion is a leaf. And they look leaf-like in shape when you really dissect them. They're just not green. Okay, now to seven. the focus here is tissues. Any given kind of multicellular organism, well, most, not all, many multicellular organisms are organized into tissues, which are groups of different cells performing a specific function. For instance, invertebrates, any mammal, which we're members of, is made of four kinds of tissue. Any place in the body that you hack into, it's going to be made up of either muscular tissue, nervous tissue, epithelial tissue, or connective tissue. That's our tissues. Plants have their own tissues. And there are three major types that you see with different colors here. Dermal tissue, vascular tissue, and ground tissue. Now, dermis means skin, or covering, which is what skin really is. So dermal tissue is named for the fact that it forms an outer covering. That's the blue part in the cartoon. Vascular is the adjective of vessel. Vascular, so of course this is only for vascular plants. Non-vascular plants don't have vascular tissue. But that's the purple part. And so the vascular tissue contains those tube-like vessels carrying things through the plant. And then the ground tissue is kind of a catch-all category for everything else. The ground tissue is basically between the dermal tissue and the vascular tissue. But depending on where you cut the plant, you'll see these three tissues arranged differently. And that's why you have three cutaway views. You cut it at the leaf, you get that arrangement. You cut it at the stem, a different kind of an arrangement. Cut it at the root, different still, all within the same individual. But still, you have all three kinds of tissue throughout the body of the plant. Now, speaking of tissues, we're going to go through a few slides to look at specific categories of within those broad categories. In slide 8, we're looking at parenchyma cells, as you can see. Each one of these brick-like things, rectangles, that's one cell. The green things are chloroplasts within the cell. Typical plant cell that within a leaf, for instance, will have about 50 chloroplasts within it. So the green things aren't cells, those are chloroplasts. Anyway, the whole collection of these cells makes up the tissue that we call parenchyma. And there are three categories that we're going to look at that vary in their degree of toughness, basically. Parenchyma cells make up parenchyma tissue, but parenchyma cells are the least tough of the three. So parenchyma cells are not about giving the plant structural rigidity or protection. Parenchyma cells are there mostly for the job of photosynthesis. And you don't have to be a tough cell to do that if you have other tough kinds of tough cells protecting you. So the middle part of a leaf, which we call the mesophyll, where most of the photosynthesis takes place, that's made up of parenchyma cells. They're thin-walled. Any plant cell has a cell wall. The cell wall of parenchyma cells is very thin and flimsy. This is why they're least tough. Also, they remain alive at functional maturity. That should be obvious since their job is photosynthesis. You have to be alive to do that. Compare that to slide 9, though, which are collenchyma cells. Now, in the toughness continuum, these are tougher than parenchyma, but they are not the toughest. So they have thicker cell walls, and they are really about forming structures. So collenchyma cells, for instance, make up the green stem of a young plant. Let's say it's a species that is a woody plant, like a tree. Before it actually gets woody, that stem, that green stem that on the seedling, will be collenchyma cells mostly, giving it structure. Now, like, even though they're tougher than the parenchyma, collenchyma cells also remain alive at functional maturity. They do their job while they're alive. The toughest of the three are shown in 10. And I guess it's not shown on the slide, but these are called sclerenchyma. Now the sclera part of that, anyone know what that means? Also a word that we use for our own bodies, right? Where is your sclera? Sclera is the anatomical name for the white part of the eyeball, which we all think is very delicate. Any little thing you do, you're going to lose an eye. But if you actually go to dissect an eye and have to puncture it to get inside it, you get an appreciation of just how tough it is. The sclera is thick stuff and tough as hell, actually. So sclera means tough. It means tough by itself. There's a human disorder, for instance, called scleroderma, which literally means tough skin. The skin gets very thick and leathery. Well, sclerenchyma cells are named for their toughness. And so of those three that we just talked about, they are the most tough, and they are all about structure and protection. And so the strongest part of a woody plant, for instance, will be the sclerenchyma cells. And unlike the other two that end in enchyma, that we just mentioned, sclerenchyma cells die at functional maturity, and they just remain tough, dead things that give the plant rigidity and protection. They have by far the thickest cell walls. And by the way, part of the toughness is that those cell walls are rich in a polymer called lignin. You have a lot of lignin in wood, which is what makes it one of the reasons it's so strong. So they are lignified cell walls that sclerenchyma cells have and produce. Okay, 11. Here we're looking at vascular cells. So of course this applies only to vascular plants, which is mostly what we're looking at in this chapter. There are two major kinds of vessels in vascular plants. Have I given you the names yet? I don't remember whether I did or not. There's two major kinds of vessels. And those are called xylem and phloem. They're not only different in how they're made or what they're made of, but they have totally different functions. You know, like we have different vessels, arterioles, venules, veins, arteries, capillaries. Those are all blood vessels, but they all do the same thing. They conduct blood or allow blood to flow through them. Well, we also have a totally different set of vessels, the lymphatic vessels, part of our lymphatic system that run alongside our blood vessels. And those do a totally different job. They're important for immunity, but they're also vitally important because they collect the fluid that's continuously being lost from our blood vessels. So we have two sets of vessels as well, although a lot of people forget about or don't realize we have lymphatic vessels. Well, in a plant cell, you have two different vessels carrying two different things. The xylem are the vessels that conduct water primarily, but also things that are dissolved in the water, dissolved minerals. By the way, anything that is conducted through the vessels of a plant is called sap. But there's two kinds of sap. When I say sap, you're probably thinking of thick stuff, the stuff you make syrup out of. That is sap, but that's not xylem sap. Xylem sap is very thin because it's mostly water. Phloem is a separate set of vessels conducting totally different stuff. Phloem sap, the stuff that flows through phloem, has to have some water or it won't flow, but it is very highly concentrated in sugar, which is why we make syrup out of it, right? So it's very much thicker, more viscous than xylem sap. Well, not only are these different sets of tubes dedicated for conducting different substances, but they're also made out of different kinds of cells. In slide 11, we're looking at tracheids and vessel elements, which make up the xylem. So in this cutaway view, notice it kind of looks like a box of straws, but there's two sizes of straws here. It looks like you had a box of shake straws that wasn't full, and then in the spaces between you jammed a bunch of cocktail straws between them, right? Small straws and big straws. They're all part of xylem, though. So they're all conducting the same stuff, water. But the bigger ones are called vessels, bigger straws, and the smaller ones are tracheids. Well, if you look at the cells that individually make up these vessels, it should make sense to you that you have to arrange cells end to end to make a long straw-like vessel. And so this is one cell right here, and then butted right up against it is another cell. These are cylindrical and long cells that are butted up against each other at a place that's called a perforation plate. Perforation means it's full of holes. It's perforated. Well, it should make sense why it's perforated. If it was just a solid wall, you wouldn't get water through the whole tube, right? And also, these, in order to be effective at flowing a lot of water through them, which they have to be to keep the plant alive, you can't have a bunch of the normal things you have inside the cell present, because it would just stop up the flow. So tracheids, like scleroenchyma cells, when they reach maturity, they die so that they can function as hollow structures that are dead. Okay, so they get big, and then they die so that they can be hollowed out and allow maximal water to go through them. And then the water gets from one cell to the next through these perforation plates. That's in a vessel. Each cell in a vessel is called a vessel element. In tracheids, you have basically the same arrangement, that's just smaller diameter, and instead of being a butt joint between them, it's more of an overlap like you see here. But you still have openings that water flows through. All right, so that collectively makes up xylem. You have a similar situation, but also different, making up phloem in slide 12. Now, phloem is much harder to get through these straw-like vessels because it's sugar than phloem sap, I should say, is much harder to get through phloem than xylem sap is to get through xylem vessels. As you would expect, try sucking up syrup through a straw versus water through the same size straw. Much harder, right? So you might think, well, these must be also dead at functional maturity. Otherwise, you wouldn't get this thick stuff through them at all. Actually, they are not, though. The cells that make up a phloem vessel are called sieve tube elements, as you see labeled here. A sieve is something full of holes, like a strainer is a sieve. When you say someone has a mind like a sieve, that means nothing stays in it. It just goes through. The sieve tube elements, which are cells, are named for the things that are just like perforation plates in xylem, only they're called sieve plates, full of holes. The interior of the sieve tube elements, though, are hollowed out. They're hollowed out nicely to allow this thick phloem sap to go through it. But how can it be that these cells remain alive at functional maturity? I told you that they don't die, unlike the xylem cells. These ones stay alive, even though they don't. They've lost all of their cytoplasm and their organelles. That would normally kill a cell. Except these cells need to stay alive because to get that sugar into them, they need active transport, which requires a living cell. So the way they get around this is that these cells require the help of other cells to keep them alive. In isolation, yes, they would die without their major organelles. But the sieve tube elements are kept alive by next-door neighbor cells that are called companion cells. The companion cells have all the regular organelles, and so they remain alive themselves, but they also keep the sieve tube elements alive. Okay, 13. Now let's talk about growth. We've been talking mostly about structures. Plants are unusual compared to us, compared to most animals. Not all animals, but most animals have what is called determinate growth. We are examples of animals that have determinate growth, meaning we grow to a certain size, to a certain stage in our life, and then that's as big as we're going to get, at least staturally. You know, our skeleton doesn't continue getting bigger. We can put on weight, but we're not going to get taller. The skeleton's not going to get bigger. On the other hand, some organisms have indeterminate growth, and they grow until they die. Some animals are like that. Boa constrictors, for instance, will continue to get bigger and bigger until they die. But most animals are determinate. Well, plants are also, most of them are indeterminate. They grow bigger and bigger until they die. And so that's one thing that's kind of unusual about them. But the other thing is that plants continually, throughout their lifetime, have parts on them that are effectively juvenile structures. They're just like when they were a seedling, and that's where the new stuff grows from. And buds are an example of this. Buds contain juvenile material, whereas in us, we start out with juvenile tissue, but then it develops into adult tissue, and that's where we are. In a plant, this juvenile tissue that a plant has throughout its lifetime is found in what are called meristems. And so the tissue that makes up meristems can be called meristematic tissue, just means in the meristems. Back to that in a minute, but when a plant grows, it can do so in two fundamentally different ways that we call primary growth and secondary growth. Primary growth, all plants are capable of, and even in plants in which both kinds of growth occur, primary growth always happens first. Primary growth refers to increase in length. So when a branch develops and gets longer, that's primary growth. Secondary growth can follow primary growth after it has already happened. Secondary growth refers to increase in diameter of a structure that's already gotten long. So when you think about a tree gets tall because of primary growth, and then it gets wide, the trunk gets wider and wider because of secondary growth. Whether it's primary or secondary growth that's occurring at meristems. Meristems are the sites at which new material is added to the plant, and therefore it grows. And so in the buds, you have apical and axillary meristems corresponding to those two kinds of buds.
Can you say that again?
Yeah, there are apical meristems and axillary meristems in the two kinds of buds, apical and axillary buds. And those are, you could classify those as primary meristems because the type of growth that's going to occur at them when they produce new cells is primary growth. It's going to increase the length of the structure. All right? If that has already occurred and you have some longish structure that can now get wide, that widening involves a totally different meristem called a lateral meristem. Lateral means to the side, right? Like a lateral in football. Well, as you see in the bracket here, there are two tissues that make up, well, actually they are both lateral meristems. There are two cambia, each of which is a lateral meristem. Cambia is the plural of cambium. There is a so-called vascular cambium and a so-called cork cambium. And in this cartoon, as you see, the vascular cambium is denoted with red and cork cambium in blue. And they form a cylinder in the cutaway view. Each one forms a cylinder. There's a cylinder inside a cylinder. The vascular cambium is the red cylinder, and then a cylinder outside of that surrounding it is the cork cambium. Together, they are both lateral meristems. And they therefore increase the thickness of something that's already grown in length. So the lateral meristems are responsible for secondary growth. And that's why when you look at the whole length of the plant, notice that the red and blue don't extend all the way to the tip. Because the very tip is capable of only primary growth until it gets long. After it's gotten long, primary growth has already happened, then the lateral meristems develop in that area, and then they can make it wider. So the places where you see the red and blue, as you go down and closer to the soil, that's older and older parts of the plant, right? So it already has the lateral meristems developed by then, and they can add to the girth or the width, the increase in diameter, yeah. Right. And after the primary growth has occurred in that region, then the lateral meristems develop and they can add to the width. But notice that what at the very tip is an apical meristem. That is a bud. That's an apical bud that includes that juvenile tissue that we call the meristem. But in this case, it's an apical meristem responsible for primary growth. That makes it longer, and once that occurs, then the lateral meristems develop in that region and allow it to become wider. The vascular cambium is named for the fact that when the cells that it produces get added to make it wider, they develop into vascular tissue, xylem and phloem. The cork cambium produces structures that are exterior to that, and produce what is the cork of a tree, for instance. Produces the bark. the stuff that you can actually feel when you go up to a tree, that's produced originally by the cork cambium. And I should also say that in addition to primary and secondary growth, there are also, we use those same names for two different categories of xylem and phloem. There's what we call primary xylem, which is produced originally by primary meristems during primary growth. That adds new vessels to begin with in a brand new part of the shoot system or root system. And then there are also secondary xylem and phloem that are produced by lateral meristems, specifically the vascular cambium, produces secondary xylem and secondary phloem. And as you can see in the cutaway view on the bottom right, the vascular cambium is this red cylinder. The secondary phloem is produced to the outside of that red vascular cylinder, phloem outward, and the secondary xylem is put down to the interior of the red cylinder. And as a secondary growth continues, it gets wider and wider, the vascular cambium gets bigger and bigger in diameter. Well, it's still adding secondary phloem to its outside, but that stuff gets sloughed off or worn away like our skin does, and you have to continually add new skin cells. So it doesn't accumulate thickness. The secondary phloem does not accumulate thickness. But the secondary xylem, which is laid down interior to that vascular cambium, that does accumulate because there's nothing, it's not exposed to the exterior that's getting abraded. So secondary xylem gets thicker and thicker. And when you know, if you look at a tree stump, most of that interior wood is just layers and layers of secondary xylem that's been laid down over the years. XIV is another picture that kind of illustrates this primary and secondary growth. If you look at, without even cutting it apart, if you just look at a branch of a tree, the very tip will feature buds, and that's how this thing is growing, because that has primary meristems in it. But the very tip is the brand new stuff. So that has just undergone primary growth for that season, and it doesn't yet have lateral meristems developed in it, which is why it can't get wide yet. But when you go farther away from the tip toward the main part of the plant, toward the trunk of the tree, for instance, you're going to older and older parts of the plant that have had more time to develop these lateral meristems and produce secondary xylem and phloem and get wider and wider. XV. You can see cells here. This is a cross-sectional view of not a stem, but a root. So this is part of a root system. And if you think back to that corn seedling I showed you when I defined root hairs, the root hairs are really the microscopic things. They're not the things you were looking at. The root hairs are the microvilli. But they're there. You just need a microscope to see them. Well, this is a tiny piece of root because these are individual cells. So this whole thing is microscopically small. But some of the cells in this, not the very outer layer, which is a cortex, but just the outermost layer of big cells here, only some of those cells produce these root hairs. Some of them don't. And so you notice that they're also colored. Now the coloring here isn't natural. They've modified them so that genetically so that they become a color if they have a gene expressed and otherwise they don't, so they can keep track of it. What they were trying to figure out here is how do these cells basically know whether or not they should grow these root hairs? And they finally figured it out. Notice that all these ones, that are not blue, that are in this outermost layer of big cells, those are the only ones that are growing the hairs. The blue ones are not. And do you notice the difference that they noticed? What is different about them? It's not their shape of the cell, not the size of the cell. But if you look carefully, every one of these white ones, which are the only ones that do develop them, those are in direct contact with two cells in the next inner layer. See that? Whereas each of the blue ones, which don't develop them, they're in contact with only one cell in that next inner layer. And that's the signal that tells them yes or no, you should or shouldn't grow these root hairs. By the way, they all have the ability to grow the root hairs, right? This is another example of what we've talked about already, that when we're talking about heterochrony, for instance, all of the cells throughout the body have all the genes. So whether something does something or not is really another way of saying its genes are either turned on or turned off. They have the same genes, though. Anyway, let's go to slide 16 and look at a root tip, which is an interesting place because it's also a site for primary growth. Primary growth doesn't happen just in the root system, in the shoot system. It also occurs in the root system. Obviously, roots get longer and longer, right? So this is also primary growth, and it occurs by the addition of new cells. Multicellular organisms in general get big not by making one cell huge, whole body size, but by adding a bunch of new cells, right? Same way we grow. And so as a root gets longer and longer, it's doing so because more and more cells get added at the tip end, the apex of the root branch, which is the bottom part on this cartoon. Now, the very bottom of it is a root cap, and that's not where new cells are created. The meristem, which is the place where there is actually new cells being produced, that's right behind it, so just above it in this picture, which is labeled the zone of cell division. Notice that it includes an apical meristem, only in a root. Still apical because it's at a tip. It's just a tip of a root instead of a shoot. So that is where cells get created. Now, what process is used to create new cells? Mitosis accompanying with cytokinesis. You have to have both, right? Because mitosis is really just division of the nucleus, but if you have that happen and cytokinesis happening, then you have two cells where you had one. So that's what cell division is referring to, mitosis and cytokinesis. And that's what's happening all the time in the zone of cell division. But as this thing adds more and more cells, most of those cells get left behind it, in a sense, which is upward in the picture, toward the already existing and older getting part of the root. So that means the zone follows the growth. It's always at the tip, leaving cells behind it to fill in the space. Does that make sense? The root cap is also produced by cells from the zone of cell division, but they're put in front of the zone. And they mature and harden and then die, kind of like our own epidermal cells. The outermost layer of our epidermis, stratum corneum, is made of totally dead cells that have been toughened as they died. And we still lose billions a day, but they protect us. They have to put up with abrasion. Just wind blows cells off of us. Well, if you're a root growing through soil, which contains glass and all kinds of sharp stuff, you're going to get the hell rubbed out of you, basically. So this root cap is a bunch of toughened dead cells that allow, that protect the cells behind them that are still living. They move stuff out of the way and take the brunt of the abuse, and they get sloughed off continuously, just like our epidermal cells do. So they have to continuously be replaced with new ones that then die and become tough. But the new ones come from this same place, the zone of cell division. Now, behind the zone of cell division, and I say behind because we're going toward the older part of the root, up in the picture, is the zone of elongation. So, the zone of cell division could also be called the zone of cell proliferation. To proliferate means to multiply. So you're going from fewer cells to more cells. That's where new cells are added. Right? Zone of proliferation. But if you're going to make two cells out of one cell, which happens in cell division or proliferation, those new cells aren't going to be big, right? One cell splitting into two is going to make two smaller cells. So once you have them made, which is the function of the zone of proliferation or zone of cell division, then those cells that have already been produced need to themselves grow. And specifically, they grow more in one direction than the other. They don't just get bigger as spheres. They elongate. They grow in the direction of the longitude of the branch of the root. So that's what's happening here. These cells in the zone of elongation used to be cells in the zone of cell division, but now they have matured and they're elongating. When they all elongate at once, that makes the whole root longer. Even older than that, higher than that on the picture, is the zone of differentiation. So when they're elongating in those, in the zone of cell elongation, that's really all they're doing. They're not really becoming different from each other. So they're all more or less the same. But that's really responsible for the elongation of the root. Once that's already happened, then these cells can start developing into different kinds of cells. For instance, cells that make up the xylem and the phloem, which is separate, which is different from other kinds of cells. That's what differentiation refers to. And that's when you finally have them sprouting root hairs like you see. Okay. By the way, this is exactly why in a class like 181, when you want to look at real examples of mitosis, you use root tips to make your slides, because you're certain to find a bunch of cells that are somewhere in mitosis, because they're dividing, and therefore you can find a good example of metaphase, of anaphase, and so on, because that's where it's happening. All right, 17. Now, we're going to see a couple slides that look very similar to this, but you have to pay attention to where we are in the body of the plant. This is a cutaway view of roots. And it's a comparison slide for these two major kinds of angiosperms, monocots and eudicots. Remember, the first slide was also that, a comparison. And this is an error in my judgment by the publishers, because in that first slide, the monocots were on the left and the eudicots were on the right. They should have stuck with that to make it easier to understand. But now they've switched it. And the eudicots are on the left here, and the monocots are on the right. It's correct as far as the information. It just makes it confusing that they've switched it. So anyway, this is a cutaway view of a root. And in a eudicot, if you take the section through the root, not the stem like we looked at in that first slide, this is through the root, then the eudicot root will have a central part where the vascular tissue is, the xylem and the phloem, and the xylem will form a cross-like structure in most species. There's variation, but this X-like shape is the xylem, and then between the arms of that cross are collections of cells that make up the phloem. So the vascular tissue is centralized in the root of a eudicot. And then you have ground tissue outside of that, filling up the space between the vascular tissue and the outermost layer is the dermal tissue. When you compare that with a typical monocot, you also in a monocot have the vascular tissue arranged in the center, but instead of having this cross-like appearance, you have little vascular bundles spread out throughout that core. All right. We'll look at real examples of this next week when you look at slides. 18, we're going to look at another slide that's coming up that's going to look almost like that. So just keep that in mind. Slide 18, though, first, is a kind of a time-lapse micrograph of a new branch of a root emerging from an already existing part of the root system. So this is a cross-section of some root that's already there, some root branch that's already there, and it itself is going to branch again. You can see it starting right here. It's basically tissue that is erupting from this vascular cylinder that's in the middle of the root system we just looked at. Now, why does it make sense that a new branch of a root erupts out of the vascular part of that pre-existing root? Why? Well, yes, but specifically, it's so that when you make, you know, that new branch has to have its own vessels, right? But those vessels would be worthless unless they're hooked up to the main system of vessels that are already there. So that's why it starts where the vessels are and adds new vessels along the way so that it's already tapped into the circulatory system of the plant. And so it basically just erupts out the side more or less at a right angle, gets bigger and bigger, and then it's its own branch with its own vessels. And then later on, it can do the same thing and branch again. Slide 19 is a very, very close-up view, because this is microscopically small because these are individual cells. But this is a view of an apical meristem. So this is a very, very young bud at the very tip of a shoot. In fact, you have three meristems here. This is an apical meristem at the very tip, and right here at the armpits, so to speak, are the axillary buds. But this is so small that you wouldn't see these three things separately unless you looked at them under a microscope. Anyway, as the meristems add new cells, these meristems will move away from each other, right? Because they're adding new cells behind them. And the bud at the tip will be farther away from the buds at the axils. And at microscopically, once it matures macroscopically, you'll be able to tell. This one's the apical meristem, these are the axillary meristems down at the branch points. But what happens here is that even though these are all three meristems, the apical meristem is in charge of the situation. It has what is called apical meristem dominance. It dominates over the axillary meristems and keeps them from developing. In other words, precedence is given to primary growth of that shoot rather than branching. It's important for plants to get long in length, to get big, especially when they're young, so that their parts can spread out, and well, so they can get taller mainly, right? Because getting taller means you're less likely to be in some other plant's shade, and therefore you have your own sunlight. So they're striving to get big, get tall. On the other hand, if something happens to destroy that apical meristem, then the other meristems can take up the job of growing. Like if something comes along and just chomps it off as food, then the dominance is broken because there's a signal that the apical bud is sending to the others, keeping them in check. When something happens to the apical meristem, that signal is lost, and therefore the axillary meristems will take up growing. And this is exactly why some people who garden go out and intentionally nip the buds, nip their plants in the buds. That's if they want them to become bushy rather than just tall and spindly. They cut off those healthy apical buds, and that's a signal to the plant that it's getting eaten or something, so it starts branching out because those axillary buds now take over the growth. Slide 20. Cartoon rendition of a leaf. A typical leaf, by which I mean a leaf for the conventional job of serving as the main photosynthetic organ. So not like a cactus. Typical broad, thin leaf is kind of a sandwich arrangement. You have a layer on top and a layer on bottom, which are epidermis, upper epidermis, lower epidermis, just like our covering is our epidermis. And just like our skin is waterproof because of lipids that are deposited between the cells, the plant epidermis up in top and bottom of the leaf are pretty much waterproof because of waxes that are produced, which are also lipids. But a leaf's epidermis cannot be completely waterproof. It wouldn't be able to live if it were waterproof, because then it would block out the ability for carbon dioxide to come in, right? If it was a barrier. Why does it need carbon dioxide? Photosynthesis. The really important thing that photosynthesis accomplishes, which only producers are able to do, and we've talked about this before when we were talking about the trophic words, is to fix carbon, right? Carbon fixation is the hallmark of photosynthesis. Take carbon from an inorganic source, carbon dioxide is inorganic, and put that into an organic molecule. We consumers cannot do that, right? Which is why we rely on the producers. Well, anyway, carbon dioxide has to get into the leaf for that to happen. So the waxy surface is waterproof to minimize the loss of water, but you have to have holes here and there in that surface so CO2 can get in, so oxygen can get out, because that's produced by photosynthesis, right? And also so water can get out. And therefore, there are little holes here and there that are called stomata. That's the plural of stoma. Stoma by itself really just means mouth or opening. So the stoma or the stomata of a leaf are really not structures. They're just openings. But they're openings that are formed by each one is formed by a pair of special cells called guard cells, that are not like the surrounding cells making up the waxy layer. Those guard cells are able to change shape, which either opens or closes the stoma. So they can control how much water they lose or how much carbon dioxide comes in by controlling the diameter of the stoma. Okay, anyway, the main part of the sandwich, the peanut butter and jelly or whatever, the interior between the two layers of bread, is mostly made up of mesophyll cells, which I was talking about earlier when I mentioned parenchyma cells. They're not tough. They don't have to be. Their job is photosynthesis, which is why you see so many chloroplasts in them. But also in that middle of the sandwich, importantly, are vessels, cells that make up the vascular tissue, xylem and phloem both. Okay, that's the main anatomy of a leaf. Let's go to 21, which is the one I was promising looks pretty much like a couple slides ago. The important difference here is that this is not a cutaway view of the root. Now we're looking at the stem. All right? And so this now, still, just like the root one, has eudicot on the left as an example, monocot on the right. Well, for a eudicot, as you see in a stem cutaway, the vascular tissue is in bundles that form a ring not too much deep to the dermal. The dermal tissue is superficial. Superficial means toward the surface. Deep means away from the surface. So the vascular bundles are deep to the cortex, but they're not too deep into the thickness. And also notice the arrangement of each bundle. Each bundle contains xylem and phloem both. But in each case, as you go around, the phloem is the superficial of the two. Each vascular bundle has phloem facing outward and xylem facing inward, just like I was talking about on the tree trunk, right? So all of these are xylem, that's inward, phloem is outwardly placed. Well, that's not how it's arranged these vascular bundles are not arranged in a circle in a typical monocot, as you see on the right. There are vascular bundles, and each bundle has xylem and phloem, but they don't form a circle. They're dispersed throughout the thickness. No matter where they are in that thickness of the overall stem, though, in a monocot, each vascular bundle still has its phloem facing outward and its xylem facing inward. This is a really kind of a duplicate slide. It's very similar to the one that I used when I first introduced you to lateral meristems, secondary growth. The lateral meristems, remember, are the vascular cambium and the cork cambium. So you still have those two things being shown here. The red part forming a cylinder is the vascular cambium, and the blue part is the cork cambium. But you see a better view of what I was indicating before as far as this vascular cambium is concerned. It's a cylinder of cells, right? And it's producing new cells by mitosis. Well, the cells that get produced by this vascular cambium that end up on the outside of the cylinder develop into secondary phloem. And those are going to be responsible for conducting phloem sap, the stuff you make maple syrup out of. That's why to make that, you just tap in, not very deep, into the maple tree. Because that phloem is toward the outer edge. The cells that are produced by mitosis from that same cylinder but get positioned to the inside of that cylinder develop into xylem, specifically secondary xylem. And so year after year, those build up thickness, which become the rings of a tree, if you look at it in cutaway. The rings are really just differences in the thicknesses season after season of secondary xylem. But they still exist because they're not exposed to the things that would wear them away. Secondary phloem gets added also every season, but since it's facing outward, it gets worn away like our epidermal cells of our skin does. And so our skin doesn't get thicker and thicker, even though we're adding cells all the time. We're just replacing ones that are lost. Okay, that's the main point of that slide. And if you still don't understand that, then here's a cartoon version in 23. So the vascular cambium is a thin layer of cells, basically one layer thick, represented by all these C's. C stands for the cambium. Okay? So it's just one cell layer thick, but it forms a cylinder. And when one cambium cell undergoes mitosis, it's going to produce two cells, right? Well, when one cell turns into two, the original cell is no longer there. So when a cambium cell undergoes mitosis, you can't use both of those cells to be xylem or phloem, because that would deplete the population of cambium cells, right? Therefore, when one seed becomes two cells, one of those two cells becomes the new cambium cell to replace the one that just split. It sticks around in the cambium, in other words. The other one can become either a xylem cell or a phloem cell, depending on which side of the cylinder it gets positioned in. Positioned inward, it becomes xylem. Positioned outward, it becomes phloem. Okay. 24 is the last slide, and here we see a cutaway view of a log that's been sawn off. When you look at the secondary xylem that I was talking about, which is most of the thickness of a log, you not only see rings, which I just described, but typically the middle part will be darker, just like you see in this cartoon. It's all secondary xylem, which was made to conduct water, right? That's what xylem is for. But all the secondary xylem that's close to the center, the closer you get to the center, the older it is, right? It was laid down first. It's been around all those years. Well, when it was first made, that xylem was open and able to conduct water. It had to, or the plant would die. But over the years, they eventually become clogged with resin. And so the only part of this secondary xylem that really is functional as xylem, conducting water, is the outermost part, which is the newest stuff that was laid down the last couple seasons. It's still open, not clogged. The darker stuff is darker because of resin that's clogging it. That makes it useless as far as water conduction is concerned, but it makes it strong stuff, and it really is an important, it's kind of like our endoskeleton. It's supporting that massive weight of the tree, even though it's no longer functioning as a vascular system. So the red part here is the vascular cambium, and then the stuff exterior to that, the immediate stuff that is exterior to that is the secondary phloem, but then the superficial most part is the bark itself. And that's produced by the cork cambium, which is even more super. That's the cylinder that's outside of the vascular cambium. That produces the outermost part of the tree trunk, which is the what we call bark is really, what we call bark is really cork. The true bark is the cork and deeper layers as well. But you don't have to go very deep to get into to damaging that vascular cambium. So, I'm not saying you should, but a quick way of killing a tree, not quick, a sure way of killing a tree is by what is called girdling. Even a huge tree that's healthy, if you just make a slit all the way around it, which is what girdling means, a girdle is something that forms a ring. If you go deep enough that you're damaging that vascular cambium and you do that all the way around, then it's not going to be able to get any water to the top of the tree, and it's going to kill it. It'll take it time to die, but it certainly will die. You make sure that's it? Yes, it is.